Good morning. It is 11:01 a.m. We are here today, July 11, 2025, via Zoom meeting for the motion hearing of OPAPA 25-007 ASC Trust LLC versus the Government of Guam Retirement Fund. Presiding over the hearing today is Public Auditor Benjamin J.F. Cruz. For the record, also present from the Office of Public Accountability are Jerick Hernandez and Marianne Maglonia. Will appellant ASC please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Public Auditor, Counsel. William Brennan from the Areola Law Firm for ASC Trust, the appellant in this matter. We won't have a management representative with me today. Thank you.
Thank you. Will purchasing agency GGRF please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning. Thank you. My name is Arsima Muller, Carl Smith Ball for purchasing agency, the Government of Guam Retirement Fund. There is no institutional representative present today.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, counsel. We have one motion this morning. It's the motion dismissed by the retirement fund. Are we ready to proceed?
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Public Auditor.
Okay. You may begin, Ms. Muller.
Thank you, Mr. Proctor. Today, there's really only one issue before you, whether ASC timely filed this protest. Under the procurement statute, a protest must be filed within 14 days after the aggrieved party knows or should know of the facts giving rise thereto. If ASC did not timely file its protest, your honorable office would have no jurisdiction over the appeal. This is not in dispute. In this case, the RFP was issued on March 17th. In the RFP, as with any solicitation, is a list of evaluation factors and how much weight they would be given. Specifically, if we take a look at the RFP on page PR00045, there are nine evaluation factors, including the plan for performing the required services, ability to administer the plan in a cost-effective way, breadth and depth of experience, ability to be responsible and accessible, knowledge of Guam public pension funds, ability to improve participant satisfaction, educational resources, and ability to provide ongoing training, record of past performance, and cybersecurity and participant data protection. A local preference is not included in the evaluation factors explicitly or even implicitly. There's nothing in the evaluation factors even about geographical location. This is in contrast to other parts of the RFP that refer to the winning offer being licensed in Guam and having employees located on island, for instance, in PR 120 and 121. So it's clear from the face of the RFP that had the agency wanted to include a local preference in the evaluation factors, it could have done so since it included reference to geography and other parts of the RFP. But it didn't do so. And if that is the sole basis of ASC's protests, ASC had all of the facts before it on March 17th when the RFP was issued. But certainly on March 31st, when ASC submitted a question in writing to GGRF, it confirmed that it was aware of this issue as of that day. So even if we go off of the later date, 14 days from March 31st was April 14th, ASC did not file a protest until April 16th, 2 days after that. There's our position, since timeliness is a jurisdictional bar, we submit that this appeal must be dismissed. In its opposition, ASC claims that the clock should start to run from when it received a response to its question from the agency on April 10th. ASC claims that it needed to receive confirmation from the agency that it was acting in contravention of the law before it could act. Respectfully, this is not what the procurement statute provides. In the DFS case, the Supreme Court made clear that a party becomes aggrieved pursuant to the procurement code at the point at which they become entitled to a remedy. This means that they become aggrieved when they become aware of a violation. The focus is not on what is being protested, but on the knowledge of the facts supporting the protest. The protest must be filed within 14 days after the disappointed bidder or offer had notice of the grounds for the protest. As I already discussed, it is the agency's position that the RFP is clear on its face. So ASC became aware of the facts underlying the present protest on March 17th when the RFP was issued, and confirmed this on March 31st when it sent its letter. Again, if we were to go with the later date, it would still be untimely. I would note that the DFS case dealt with three protests. ASC cites to the second protest, which related to the purchasing agency's use of letter designations. In that case, the court agreed that the appeal was timely because the agency had not made a definitive decision yet. That's not what we have here. In this case, the RFP was issued and included evaluation factors that were clear on their face. I would submit that this case is more akin to the first protest and the DFS case, in which the protester knew of facts about improper contact between the agency board members and a competing bidder in October 2012, sent a letter to the agency a month later to investigate this issue, and did not file a protest until April 2013. There, the Supreme Court stated that the clock started as of October 2012, when the bidder first learned about the improper contact. The bidder did not need the agency to respond to its letter before it could submit a protest. We submit that that should be the case here as well. Similarly, in the data management resources decision, the clock was found to start from when the bid was opened, because all of the required information was in the bids. Likewise here, all of the information for ASC to protest was included in the RFP. There is no requirement, as ASC claims, that the agency confirm it is not in compliance with the FAR procurement code for the clock to start. Finally, on the John Dale decision, ASC claims that this case is more akin to John Dale than the two data management resources. Respectfully, we disagree. In that case, the issue was whether the winning offeror was licensed in Guam. The court held that the clock started from when the losing offeror received information relating to the winner's license. The losing offeror in that case could not have known about the winner's business license or lack thereof at the time of award. It only found out after the agency confirmed this. In other words, the losing offeror did not have knowledge of the facts underlying the protest until the agency confirmed it. Again, it's our position that is not the case here. All the facts that underlie ASC's claim are present in the RFP itself. As of the day that the RFP was issued, ASC should have known there was no local preference in the evaluation factors. The fact that ASC raised this on March 31st again confirms this, but even if we go off of that date, ASC still failed to meet the 14-day deadline. As we submit, the dismissal is proper under these circumstances. Unless Mr. Public Auditor has any questions for me, I'm happy to answer at this time. Otherwise, I yield to
I'll
Mr. Brennan.
Questions after I hear from Mr. Brennan.
Thank you.
Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Mr. Public Auditor. So first, I will agree with opposing counsel. I'm not disputing the law that the timelines are jurisdictional. I've argued cases where I've succeeded for the purchasing agency with those arguments as well, and for, you know, other private enterprise clients. I think one of the first things I have to raise, because I think it does sort of give this case the best color in terms of what decision you have before you. I'm not sure I understand what GGRF's position is on the local preference today. After I read the reply brief that they filed earlier this week, I went back, I read through their response to ASC's protest, I read through their agency statement, I read through their rebuttal to our comments on the agency statement, and I'll just highlight for you, Mr. Public Auditor, in the April 23rd, 2025 decision denying the protest, they rejected ASC's contention that the statute mandates preference in the local preference in qualifications-based selection process. Then in response to our notice of appeal in their agency statement, during the pre-contracting, the evaluation stage, no contractor was identified that could not meet the local preference. Therefore, 5008 has not been violated yet by the retirement fund. That was their position on pages 4 to 6 of their agency statement. in their rebuttal to our comments on their agency statement, where we raised this glaring inconsistency, they said the local preference is discretionary and not mandatory. And so they could apply it if they want, even though it's still opaque to this day that if they do apply it, when will they apply it? How will they apply it? And this is precisely why ASC asked the question they did on March 31st. I note, secondly, and you know, there's actually a regulation that says what has to be in an RFP. And that regulation is 2 GAR Division 4, Section 3114F. And it states very specifically an RFP must have, you know, these following, I have it right in front of me, the type of services required, a description of the work involved, an estimate of when and for how long. What you won't find there is Section 5008. Nothing in the regulations requires the government, in this case, the retirement fund, to list that it will comply. It does not need to have an affirmative statement that it will comply with Guam law at 5008. And I didn't say this flippantly in our comments on the agency statement. I wasn't, you know, I really want to set up the stakes for this type of case. The retirement fund's position, taken to its logical conclusion, will mean unless government agencies have an affirmative statement that they will comply with every single specific provision of Guam law applicable to their solicitation within the solicitation, they will have a 14-day window where, you know, their position will be open to challenge. And after that date, government agencies will have license to flout the law. That's essentially what will happen in this case if we agree with the retirement fund's position. If ASC's claim is dismissed just on the basis that, you know, we didn't say we were going to follow this law in our solicitation, therefore you should have known we wouldn't follow the law, what else are they excused from complying with? Because nobody called them out within the 14 days, right? I know it seems sort of reductive to say that, but that is where this case goes if we agree with their contention, right? And so I do have, you know, I do want to push back on this idea that, you know, we were untimely because immediately from when the solicitation was published, we need to identify every specific requirement in Guam law that's not, you know, affirmatively stated and file a protest. That's what they're saying. We have to file a protest saying, hey, you didn't list these, therefore you must comply with these. Confirm? Question mark. Instead, what normally happens is there's an assumption that an agency is going to follow the law. And when a bidder becomes aware that a violation of law has occurred or aware of facts that will result in a violation of law, that's what triggers the protest, the right to protest. And that's what Judge Iriarte in the JMI case says entitles the bidder to a remedy. It's a violation of law, makes the bidder aggrieved and entitled to a remedy. If we want to go to the specific case law, I'm aware that there were 3 protests in DFS. There were actually numerous claims. It wasn't just 3. And, you know, I had the benefit. I worked at the legislature at the time. It was the hot topic. Everyone was talking about Chairman Santis and Director Tolan accepting these gifts on the Jeju trip, the inaugural Jeju trip. Everybody knew about it. They knew about it in October. But DFS didn't file a protest. They sent a letter of concern in October, but didn't file a protest until April. The Supreme Court found that was improper. The fact that GIA directors on their board were on the delegation trip for GVB was known publicly, reported in the newspaper. DFS sent a letter of concern in October. Hey, you know, why are they taking a trip to Korea as part of a GVB delegation where they're given tours of Lotte's principal offices, and yet you have this RFP pending? No protest until April. So, of course, I'm aware that there are other bases of protest that were relevant in the DFS case. But the reason I highlight the letter designation is because I think that is the most apt, factually analogous basis to this case. There, When the matter, the RFP, was brought to the board for approval, this was unprecedented. It was the first time that the airport started talking about, oh, we're not going to tell you who the offerors are. Instead, we've assigned them all random letter designations. You're going to be presented with a ranking 1, 2, and 3, offer A, B, and C. You won't know who they are, but we'll need a vote on that. Director Untalan, I believe it was, raised the question, hey, we've never done this before. Can we get an opinion from legal before we proceed? Okay, let's continue the meeting. There was no definitive answer on that date, the first board meeting, and I think it was March 28th, that they were going to use the random letter designation. Instead, they came back later in April, they used the random letter designation, and the Supreme Court found they weren't triggered to protest. DFS protests didn't start on the first meeting because there was no definitive statement, we're going to do this or we're not going to do this, right? Instead, that didn't happen till the second meeting in April, which was less than 14 days before the protest was filed, completely rejecting GIAA, the purchasing agency's argument that, hey, they knew something was up on that date, on the first board meeting date. Therefore, that was the date to protest. You know, if I were to put this differently, what remedy if at the end of that first board meeting, DFS said, okay, they may be using an ad hoc letter designation. I don't know what it's going to be. What remedy was DFS entitled to that day? Airport, we protest because you're not sure what you're going to use. I think that was the real import and gravity of the Supreme Court's decision.
But didn't the retirement fund make it clear that there were nine things that they were going to look at for the evaluation?
Those nine things track what are in the statute for minimum qualifications. And I think this is where we have some, you know, we don't have a good body of law on local preference, but local preference is not bound to minimum qualifications. That's what I'll agree with the retirement.
But this is an RFP. How would the agency take into account local preference when an RFP, you don't get to see price until after you evaluate the bidders and come to a determination of who the top bid, I mean, the most qualified bidder is, and then open up the price package? Because there is no, you can't see the price in RFP before you make the evaluation. Is the fact that there's nothing in the nine, that there wasn't a 10 on their list, enough to give you notice that they weren't going to do it? Is, as you put it, I've been mulling over this with the staff, just there, as you put it, there is no great body of law on how to be able to address this with an RFP. And maybe the Supreme Court's going to need to make some determination on what they think, how to evaluate this.
So the two cases we do have on point, this is a little bit more a peek into the merits. This was in our response to the agency comments. So these cases are Emission Technologies and Radiocom. And if you look, the way I would explain why the nine evaluation factors for minimum qualifications aren't the same thing as the local preference is the same way Speaker Terlahi, when she was the hearing officer, decided. Because the statute itself says it's price or availability on Guam, right? It's an or, it's not an and. So it's not price and availability. It's price at 85% of the next lowest bidder if they're off island, or they are available on Guam. And you'll find this on page 4 and 5 of our statement, or our response to the agency statement. But essentially what Speaker Terlahi, then hearing officer Terlahi, said in Radiocom and Emission Technologies, is that local preference exists independent of the actual qualifications. And that makes sense because you cannot say local preference is a qualification of, is part of the minimum qualifications, because then I think I would agree that it could be consistent with the retirement fund that we're just, you know, turning it into you just get an advantage, right, automatically in the evaluation process. I don't think that's what Speaker Terlahi said. What she said was you can apply the local preference in the RFP setting and you can evaluate those offerers who meet the local preference first, right? And then you go to whether they're minimum qualified. So it's a two part. Do they get the local preference? If they do and nobody else is on island, then we go to minimum qualifications. That's what she set up in terms of procedure. And that's really the only precedent we have to rely on. I think it's good precedent. It's harmonized with the statute at 5008 because it talks about availability of services in Guam or price, right? So it's not just price. And that's where I do disagree with the retirement fund. The statute uses the word or, and I think the legislature was very clear to use the word or. So it's availability or price. And then obviously there are those other requirements I paraphrase, but it's a service business actually in Guam, does a substantial portion of its business in Guam, hires at least 95% of persons from, it's really the FSM or Guam, and the offer offers services sought, or no off-island vendor offers the services at less than 85%. So there is an or in that statute that I think would control in response to the question you asked, and that's why it doesn't have to go into the nine factors. But again, I think I'm, you know, going too far into the merits. I don't want to, you know, but I mean, that's a good argument for why, if how would AFC have known, right? If we were just looking at radio comm and emission, it shouldn't be part of the nine factors. It should just be applied at some point by the retirement fund before they move to evaluation. That's the precedent ASC had before it. And so that's why they tried to clarify that.
If they were to do that, that would just, it wouldn't even be a preference. It'd be an absolute exclusion of anybody from off island.
That's what Speaker Terlahi, as I read RadioCom, she's essentially saying you must inquire whether these services are offered in Guam and whether they meet the local preference before you can even go to off island vendors. That was her analysis she engaged in.
But that would make it absolute.
It would make it a preference. I think it would make it a preference.
Yeah, the preference would be absolute, not 85% of what the cost would be. You would never be able to get an off-island bidder book in an RFP because of the local bidder would by that evaluation thing be absolute.
In the services context, I think that is the actual practical.
That's what I mean in services. I mean, take for instance, if here in our office, where we're taking bid, we're always asking for RFPs for auditing services. We're having problems getting auditors on island. Now there's only one, well, two. One firm and a second, but the second doesn't pick up very much. Just the retirement fund is their only client in getting RFPs. And we're currently going out to bid for something that is fairly substantial. No one wants to bid. I mean, nobody, I mean, two people picked up the bid, but the local bidder did not submit on time. They decided against it. So now we're using, you know, AGA and all kinds of things to send it all over the country. It would mean that from now on, when we start a bid, EY would, or one of the two locals would get it immediately without us even looking to see whether an off-island firm would be better suited to do the services that we need.
I think that's correct. And quite frankly, I mean, I could envision it being reasonable that the legislature had, you know, I apologize. I know you served. I'm not sure that you guys amended 5008, but let me just say that I think that the legislature could have envisioned wanting to set up a regulatory scheme where the government of Guam was encouraged to work with companies like EY, which maintained a local affiliate here, which maintained local auditors here, which employed 95% or more persons who would be entitled to work in Guam. That, I mean, that seems like a valid goal of our legislature and valid public policy that they set. Now, granted, it may result in the services context of we're only working with local companies if they qualify. Absolutely. But I mean, that is to foster those types of professional services here. I think that's a great goal of our legislature. And if somebody wanted to change that and the way the statute's worded, I don't think it's, you know, this is how we've always done it, and therefore we shouldn't.
Would that be the reason why the local preference and the RFP is worded differently from The veterans one?
Yeah, I mean, just service disabled veteran, they just completely said except professional services, right? And so that's what I was pointing out in the, in the definitions. They didn't make that same exception in these local business preference. They just said supplies and services. If these apply, you prefer these businesses. Service disabled veteran, supplies and services, except professional services as defined in 5216. So I think if I could step back, I think that was intentional. Again, I could see the legislature, if Guam has a shortage of auditors, why not encourage a local affiliate that houses auditors in Guam, persons authorized to work in Guam, and guarantee that if they meet the requirements, they'll be preferred for local business, local government business. It could encourage local professionals to stay here in the services or even non-professional services context, because we're not specifically looking at price immediately. We're focusing on qualifications. If you are locally preferred and meet the minimum qualifications, this two-part inquiry, Judge Terlahi, or excuse me, Speaker Terlahi engaged in radiocom and emission technologies, then it's appropriate to prefer those entities, right? And before I get too far off track, I did just want to highlight it wasn't a business license issue in JMI and John Dell. That was the case 3 years ago. I mean, I litigated that before you, and I was the one in that case arguing this is untimely. And the reason I argued it was untimely is because I said these guys came in, they're protesting, and they're saying the selected offer, not the awarded offer, there was no contract in that case, doesn't have a contractor's license. Well, then we rebut and we say, wait a minute, you know who has contractor's license because that list is publicly available. It's published in the newspaper and on the GCLB's website. And Judge Iriarte found, she's like, the information may be generally available, but the right of a party to protest isn't triggered until they're aggrieved and have knowledge of the facts. And it wasn't until Ed Elow, the president of the company, called the contractor's license board, and he provided a record that said, I called them on this date. I protested several days later. For us, when I represented the purchasing agency, well, he said, well, that was way more than 14 days because the proposals were ranked and the ranking was announced at the board meeting in July. And you were there, Mr. Elow. You knew who was ranked higher than you. And therefore, on that day, because it's public information who has a contractor's license and who doesn't, you should have known from that day. The court rejected that and said generally public aware information or available information is not the trigger. It's when we can prove that the bidder has knowledge of that generally available public information, right? And so that's actually, I think that there is a sort of, I'm not sure, Mr. Public Auditor, that DMR is compliant with that decision. I'll just put it that way. I fully respect, you
Yeah,
decided to.
and but Judge Iriarte's decision didn't go up on appeal.
Correct, but it's still, I mean, it is still
Yeah,
some precedent.
and Judge Terlahi recently remanded something, and I keep waiting because the Supreme Court has at least three, if not four, cases that it's heard. But no decision has been made by them on my reading of the 14 days of known or should have known.
If I could, I could offer
Because
you.
I've taken the, I, because the Supreme Court didn't explain that, I've taken the extreme view of you know or should have known when you knew. Or should have known. And some of them have been, some of my decisions have been just insane. I held somebody to have known before as soon as the bid was announced because they knew who the other bidder was and they knew the other bidder had a C rating that same year. So they should have known that that person should not have been able to pick up something. I mean, pick up the bid because they weren't, shouldn't have been qualified. But I haven't gotten word back from the Supreme Court whether or not that's a insane reading of their known or should have known. And I on other times I and on this one it's this is an RFP and maybe some guidance from them on what known or when the know or no should have known should have tolls the time
It won't
because
toll,
it's.
yeah. Yeah, I think it won't toll. I think we know that from DFS. I think that what I tried to give you is, I think the most on point and factually analogous cases are the designation issue in DFS and then the JMI case, just in terms of, what agency knows, what's generally available publicly. I think those are the factors that would be relevant in this case, just on the inquiry of know or shouldn't known. But again, I think I could also reconcile your decision in DMR. Essentially, if they're considering a lower bid than me, the only way that I would win is if they're non-responsive, and so I should go in and investigate. And that was sort of what you said in DMR, that if it obviously they're going to win because they have a lower price, so your only argument would be they're non-responsive. So go out, look for the basis. They waited 30 days to do it, rather than doing it right away. So that would be sort of how I would, I guess, reconcile DMR with this case and still say that, yeah, I think ASE is timely, obviously. I'm arguing that before you. But I think where I would leave you, Mr. Public Auditor, just so that I can round up my argument and just make sure I answer any of your other questions, is if you rule that ASE is untimely here, what does that mean? Does that mean that the retirement fund is excused from compliance with the law, right? Simply because we didn't call them out that they didn't affirmatively state they would comply with the law earlier. Granted, I recognize you're saying, maybe it should have been a 10th evaluation factor. The problem is I don't think that squares with Radiocom and Emission Technologies. It's more of a, more of a merits issue, but to the extent, we're tying the merits to the timeliness question, I do think there is an issue there, because if the only authority that ASC had available to it said that it doesn't have to be. Nobody has ever said the local preference has to be explicitly made evaluation criteria. Speaker Terlahi said something very different. It has to be a first inquiry. Kind of a way to explain how I understand her process is, you cannot rule out a company for not having a business license at the time of proposal, but you can give a company an advantage for having a Guam business license based on the local preference at the time of proposal. That's really the impact of her decision. Is that, you can't, we're not going to say you don't have a business license, you cannot offer a proposal, you need to give me one today. But if you do give a business license and you meet the other requirements, you are entitled to preference. And that's why it can't be the evaluation factor. It has to be a two-part inquiry. And that's how you harmonize it with the
So that
circuit.
would make it absolute.
I think it is absolute. I mean, granted, the
Okay.
legislature used the word preference, but I mean, it works much more like a set aside from the federal government. If you need like a comparison, it is, if they qualify, they get it, right? And I could envision a situation where it's absolute, but we have two local companies or more who qualify. They would still have to compete, but we're setting up a playing field where our government of Guam prefers those vendors in Guam, who are employing residents of Guam, people authorized to work in Guam, who do most of their business in Guam, who are bringing professionals here, auditors, lawyers, doctors, nurses for professional services, engineers. I think that aligns with the goals of the legislature here. And I can't see how we could read the statute any other way.
Okay. You have any further comment? Mr. Brennan, do you have anything else?
No, Mr. Public Auditor, unless you have questions, I'll return it to Ms. Mueller. I had a little bit of extra time there, so thanks for your patience.
Oh, no problem. There's no time limitations here. Ms. Mueller,
Thank you.
I'll allow you to make your rebuttal and then address the questions that I posed to Mr. Brennan, and I'm not sure if you need additional time to review Radiocom.
No, I think I'm okay, but I just wanted to address a couple of comments by Mr. Brennan. So I think in discussing John Dell, I did say business license, so I apologize if that was just misspeak. But I think in that case, what's important is that the information that was needed in order to determine whether or not there was a basis for the protest was information outside of the RFP. And what we're saying is the face of the RFP here. And I understand Mr. Brennan to be arguing that the local preference is primary, and then you don't even get to the evaluation factors until you've considered the local preference. So if that is what he's arguing, you can see that from the RFP. That's our position. It's not, there is no, there's nothing in the RFP that says we will, if you are a Guam business, you will get first preference. So there was no need to go outside of the record or outside of the RFP even, as there was in the John Dale case. And the rest of the arguments, Mr. Public Auditor, I would submit are goes to the substance of the claims and our potential defenses to those issues. But again, the issue here is when they knew or should have known of the facts underlying the potential protests. And again, it's our position, the RFP is clear on its face. If they saw there was no local preference and they believed that the legislature mandated that before you even get to the evaluation factors, I think he made that pretty clear that then you should have known that's the time that you should have submitted a protest. But again, even if you went off the later date, which is when they submitted their, after they've reviewed the RFP and submitted their question, at that time, they're confirming that they didn't see a local preference, and the 14-day clock would have at least started from that date.
So your contention is that even accepting arguendo that the that there is the radiocom argument of local preference, the fact that it wasn't in the value, it wasn't in the RFP when it was issued, it wasn't part of the nine step, in fact the two step that was required or was the position of the hearing officer in radiocom, was not being followed by the retirement fund, that he knew about it when the bid went out. And maybe if he didn't know about it on the 17th, by the time they came around to the 31st, when they decided to write the letter, that they knew or should have known that the RFP was deficient and therefore should have filed within 14 days.
That is correct. And that's, as I understood, Mr. Brennan arguing the two-step process that they saw that's not included in there. So they knew or should have known of the facts providing the basis for their protest.
Okay. Anybody else want to add anything? Anything else? Mr. Brennan?
Yeah, just a couple points. So I've just got to sort of take this a step back. I mean, if that were the case, that, you know, we just had to say, they didn't say, again, I couch it as they didn't say they're going to comply with the law, shouldn't we just assume that? First, we're just going to open the floodgates to protest level. It may not come to you, Mr. Public Auditor, but we are putting a burden on those people trying to do business with our government to come in and police the government. And that's where I call this. This turns our procurement and appeal scheme into a catch me if you can sort of proposition. We're not going to follow the law unless somebody calls us out and specifically says we have to comply with XYZ, right? And if you don't, and we didn't say we would, we're excused from that. I don't think that was the purpose of these jurisdictional sort of bars, 14-day timelines. Now, whether that is the impact in some cases, you know, based on the particular circumstances, okay. Here, I'm just not, I'm just not in agreement, I guess, with the retirement fund that they, you know, essentially said we had to comply with the local preference. And it's because even now, look at their papers, right? Those excerpts I highlighted in my opening in response to the retirement fund's position, they've sort of waffled a bit, right? Oh, you know, we may apply this at the price stage, right? Or we are still economically consistent with the local preference, so no violation has occurred, right? If they're changing their position, it just furthers ASC's point that ASC was not aggrieved, right? Because what happens if we went back to April 10th and ASC, the response to ASC's question was, we will take this into consideration. We're working this in at some point, right? And we're going to do it in compliance. And our RFP is consistent economically with the local preference. ASC at that point may have just said, well, if there is some, you know, we may not have to protest this, right? That's the sort of the issue I have with them saying it was very clear. How can it have been very clear on March 31st and March 17th if even to this day, right, their papers have sort of inconsistent positions on behalf of the retirement fund? The other point I'll make is if that were the case, why did they respond affirmatively to our second basis of protest? Because if what they are saying is all the protests were untimely by April 10th or April, excuse me, April 14th, or excuse me, April 16th, because you had the RFP since March 17th. The other basis of our protest was, hey, some of your language here sort of gives an advantage to the incumbent. Do you see that? And that was based on a response to a question, right? And so why did they respond affirmatively and amend the RFP there? Surely they would have recognized that that basis of protest was also untimely. I don't mean to throw that
red. I just thought of something that I'd like the two of you to address.
Sure.
Does this make this absolute, like the preference when you're dealing with the, help me out with this, Jared, I don't know what the political correct word
to use. Are you talking about procurement from nonprofit corporations that employ people with disabilities?
Yes.
I think that is I'll say that's a method of source selection independent of the RFP process. But yes, Mr. Public Auditor, the result would be the same. It is an absolute preference and categorization of those businesses the government prefers to do business with in Guam. I think what the final point I'll leave you with in response to the retirement fund's position is, again, even if their ASC had knowledge, I have not heard what was their remedy before. I mean, should we have filed a protest to say, hey, you're going to follow the law, right? Can you just clarify 5008 applies? That's not a protest because that's, you know, we're seeking guidance, and guidance comes in the form of question and answer under our procurement code, which is exactly what ASC did. Hey, you're going to comply with the law, right? It's not a definitive, we know you're not compliant. I mean, the retirement fund, had they given any of the answers they've given in their papers on this appeal, this might not have resulted in a protest and appeal. I'll just put it that way. Thank you, Mr. Provost Goddard.
Ms. Mueller, did you assist in the preparation of the RFP for this?
I did not.
Because I'm wondering, and the price on this one would have required the Attorney General's approval of this RFP, right? Did it get the AG's approval of the RFP?
Yes, I believe so.
It received the approval of the AG or the concurrence of the AG without including a provision about local preference in the RFP. Which is a requirement of the checklist that the AG has issued for RFPs. And your RFP does not even include any mention of local preference. Correct?
That is correct.
Because at least for our office, we have a, we when we went through the checklist to make sure that our RFPs complied with the requirements of the AG, we included a phrase in there about local preference, if applicable. You want to read that to the record, Jarek?
I'm just having to find it.
Oh, wait, I have it here. Procurement, local procurement policy, W. No specification, term, condition, or qualification of this ROP shall exclude any offerer from consideration on the basis of Guam-only experience, provided that the experience of such offerer is otherwise responsive to the solicitation in accordance with the requirements of 5GCE 5008C. That's W in our RFP, and you guys don't have it on the RFP for the retirement fund. I'm wondering how that cleared the AG's office when the checklist requires some mention of local preference.
Well, I was not involved in preparation of it, but I can provide that information for you at a later date.
Yeah, and.
Yeah, if I could be heard, and I'll just, be complete candor to you, Mr. A.G. Moylan's checklist. I'm not sure about A.G. Camacho. A.G. Moylan's checklist for IFB does have a checkbox for local preference. A.G. Moylan's checklist for RFPs do not. None of the set asides, or excuse me, none of the preferences are in the RFP checklist for A.G. Moylan's checklist.
I think we're working off an older checklist because we included in our RFP.
Yeah, I can. I mean, I have it up on my screen. I just pulled it up while you were reading that provision. But I've reviewed this before. AG Moylan's does not. I could look at the older versions.
Okay. Well, I only point that out is maybe you might want to pull this back and put that RP in or something, discuss with the AG how that's going to be addressed. But I'm going to take this under advisement and see how RadioCom applies to this and whether the preference becomes absolute. And that'd be interesting.
Thank you, Mr. Public Auditor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Have a nice day.
We're off the record
at
11:50 a.m.